You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Don't you see? It's so simple. Step one, we Google the biggest flops on Broadway. Step two, we find the crazy stories behind them. Step three, we see how they lose millions of dollars.
Millions?
Broadway isn't cheap. A lot of fancy people want to be producers. Step four, find out why the show won't go on. Step five, end this episode and head to Times Square.
Times Square? That'll never work. Only Broadway successes are in Times Square.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Welcome!
What's up, theater geeks?
Hey, I'll tell you what's up before we start.
Okay.
While we were recording, I get this text message from your roommate, and I have to read it because it's really sweet. She goes, "Ladies, I loved the High Fidelity episode. It was so spot on in every way." And then she said, "I would be specific, but it would be the longest text ever." So thanks, Megan.
That's funny.
And now I'm texting her that she made a cameo in this episode.
So this episode is our usual length for a regular episode, but it is quite different than our usual episode.
Yes.
Because we are not going to talk about just one show. We are actually just going to spend this time talking about a person. And we mentioned him back in, I think probably August, we had an episode where we talked about his passing, but his memorial service is coming up in the next, by the time you get this, it may have happened already.
Mm.
So this episode is completely dedicated to Hal Prince. And young people who might be listening to us, because sometimes we do have teenagers, if you don't know who Harold Prince is, you're going to want to look him up.
Yes.
Because
He changed the face of theater.
He and Stephen Sondheim, they're a lot of us, the reason that we are obsessed with theater is because of the things that they made. And not only because of the things that they made, but there were people older than us who became obsessed with the things that they made, and then they made things that we then became obsessed with. And the reason, I mean, and there are some things that you all love without necessarily knowing who Hal Prince is. Like, there are things that you all love that were only created because a young person saw what he made and then wanted to make something else. And Lin-Manuel Miranda is one of those people. So if you love Hamilton, if you love In the Heights, the only reason we have those shows really is because of Hal Prince and what he made.
Yeah.
Because that and Jonathan Larson, those men are like why we have those shows.
Yeah.
So during this episode, we're going to talk about his life and we're going to talk about his contributions and geek over them super hard.
Ebony grabbed a bunch of tissues just before starting the recording.
I did. When he passed, I'm not a crier, and everyone who knows me knows that. I'm not a big crier, but I couldn't pull it together much of the day when I heard he died, and I didn't understand. I was like, why? The whole day sitting at my desk, and I wasn't, like, uncontrollably weeping because I would have had to leave and go home, but it was just, like, tears would just randomly, I'd think about, like, a show would pop in my head and, like, a moment because, like, so for me, my mother was, like, the impetus for me beginning to love the theater, and she's passed away 5 years now, and one of the many moments that we had were, there was one Sundays she would, and I may have told this story, I don't know, but Sundays she was a teacher. And so on Sunday nights, she would be finishing up grading papers before school the next day. And there was one Sunday evening where my brother and sister were playing outside, and I think I was having back pain or something. And I was in the living room, and my mom and I used to do, like, the TV Guide channel, and we'd wait, and we'd see what was on television, and we'd watch it together. And so this one afternoon, I'm sitting on the floor, and she's like, Eb, go to the TV Guide channel. So I do, and I'm sitting there while she's grading papers, and I'm calling out things that look interesting if I don't know what they are. And we got to West Side Story.
Yes.
And it said musical. And I was like, West Side Story. Mom, what's that? And she goes, oh, that's good. Go to that. And I've not been the same since, as I feel most. I was like,
truly,
what is that? And the only reason there is a West Side Story movie is because there was a West Side Story musical that was saved by Hal Prince.
Yeah.
Because a producer pulled out at the last minute, and Stephen and Hal were best friends, and Stephen Sondheim had been talking to Leonard Bernstein and all these great men who were making this musical about his friend for months. They weren't really moving towards adding him as producer. This woman named Cheryl bowed out at the very last minute, and the show was going to lose a bunch of money. And Stephen gave it one last push. My friend Hal is a producer. Can we please add him to the roster? They did save the show, and that's why we have West Side Story.
It's truly incredible to me. Yeah. It's truly incredible. And the relationship between Stephen Sondheim and Hal Prince from, let's just say from birth, because I don't know. I mean, I really don't know how long they were college friends.
It was South Pacific. So they were about, let's see, Hal would be 92 next year, and Stephen will be 90 next year. So they were 2 years apart. So Hal was 19, Stephen was 17 when they met. That's how old they were.
Yeah.
So they, I mean,
but their relationship was lifelong at that point.
Totally. And they met at South Pacific, I think was what I read or what I saw. It was South Pacific. I know it's a huge, weird full circle moment for Hal because the first show he saw was, it wasn't the first show he saw, because the first show he saw was Julius Caesar. But he saw South Pacific and met Stephen, and then the show that's still on Broadway 30 years later is at that same theater that he directed called Phantom of the Opera.
Yep.
At the Majestic Theater. And so it's this, like, crazy. His story is just, it's just crazy.
It's, okay, and we both watched the PBS.
Yeah.
It wasn't great performances, was it?
No, it's called American Masters.
American Masters, thank you.
It's one of those, yeah.
Where it's like basically a documentary about him, and it's just really spectacular. Yeah, but he tells the story, well done. But he the way that he paints it is so, it's so him, and in the way that he would create, where he was talking about South Pacific, and he said, you know, it was cinematic. You know, he would watch the stage, and before the last scene left, there would be a scrim that would come in, and the whole next scene would come in, and then that scrim would come out, and then they were able to create these, like, close-up moments simply by using their lighting, and he was so impacted by that, that is ultimately where his style and where his creative trajectory came from in just a massive way.
Yeah.
He's incredible.
He really is.
And to hear him talk, too, because he's so humble and so modest. Like, he'll just be telling a story about how he created the, you know, when, so basically what'll happen is that there's a couple of people that are sitting on stage, and you'll kind of hear some mumbling. It'll be a little bit weird, and there's just a bunch of set pieces, and they're all covered up with silk, and you know, you'll hear some, it'll just make you feel a little uncomfortable, and then out of nowhere you'll hear this kind of like a crack, and then this, you know, this man who's high above he'll just start talking, and he'll start selling things. And then you've got this veiled woman in a wheelchair, and she'll say 25, you know, and the way he described, that's the beginning of Phantom of the Opera. And it's so funny because I had to kind of watch and just listen to this documentary because I was dealing with dog vomit, but that's a story that you should have heard last time. But I overheard him talking about this particular scene, and I went, I know that show. because I did that show. Yeah. But I was in that scene. Like, I was on stage during that whole thing. But it was also like, nobody understood. None of us actors understood why the heck we were there. Yeah. Because my partner and I were behind the curtain in the dark. Essentially.
Yeah.
Just to stage right of the auctioneer, who is way up on a ladder, getting ready to plug in the chandelier. And then you've got all the people before the curtain, and they can all be seen, but some of them are in the dark as well. And we're just clapping. You know, if someone's, if they sell something, but you know, he did, this was funny too, because he mentioned this as well, and we were all told, yeah, just don't worry about clapping, just kind of change it up, you know, so that it's erratic. And I was just like, okay, I don't understand, but okay, whatever. It was not until I saw the documentary that I finally understood what the heck I was doing. But I love that about him too, because he was so forthcoming with his actors. Yeah. It said in one of the scenes in the documentary, and I can't remember who was talking at this point, but it was a woman, and she said he was, it may have been Susan Stroman.
Okay.
She said he was so good about explaining the entire arc of the scene before he blocked it.
Yeah.
So that by the time he had people on the stage, everyone kind of just knew how to do it and how to do it naturally.
I think that's birthed from, and he said this, you know, he loves actors.
Yeah.
And I think some directors don't like actors.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Oh, yes.
And for people who, directors who love actors and have a true appreciation, understanding, and reverence for the fact that they're pouring their heart and soul into a character and laying it on display for everyone to judge and critique.
Well, and let's be honest. Yes, people do talk about the directing, but if we fail, it's it is the actors on stage that fall flat on their face.
So it's, It's really wonderful to hear somebody who is that revered and that respected also respect the craft of those, that he understands that this is a collaboration and understands that, like, if I don't tell you where we're going and what we're doing, and I don't, because one thing he said, and I love this, he said, you don't tell Angela Lansbury how to act.
Yes.
You know, I was like, right, no.
Yes.
She knows what she's doing. You have to trust your actors.
Yes. And if you can't trust them, then you shouldn't hire them.
Right.
Yes. Yes. This is what I love too, because he mentioned, he was like, the only thing that I really don't like about this business is the auditioning.
Yeah.
But he said it because he said, it's just awkward and you don't, you know, you're not, it's a terrible system.
Yeah. He said, oh, I wrote the quote down.
Yes, please read it.
It's so,
I'm sure it's the exact same thing that I'm thinking of right now.
No, totally. Because I remember I was like, I don't like auditioning people. Okay, this is his quote.
Yeah.
Auditioning is the worst possible way to cast a show, except for any other way.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. It was so brilliant, but he said it in his Hal Prince way. Uh-huh. So it was like, it took me a second to be like, oh. It's so true, though, but I'm so glad that he finally, you know, someone had the guts to finally say it.
Yeah.
And nothing's going to change, obviously. No. It's been that way for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
It's not going to get any worse, but he mentions why. And one of the reasons, he says, is that some people are just really good at auditioning.
Yeah.
And this reminds me, I was listening to NPR earlier. Mm-hmm. Well, I was actually listening to WNYC, but a lot of NPR plays on. Anyway. And there was a story of a girl who couldn't get in. She's doing like community college because she can't get a good enough ACT score, SAT score, whatever it was, the test that she was taking, because she's just not good at taking tests. Mm-hmm. But she's got amazing grades, which is why, you know, she's able to take the classes that she's taking right now anyway. But like, how the testing system is antiquated and it's geared towards the rich and the people that are able to afford to, you know, to have their kids sleep well and eat well and get a tutor if they need to. And so like, it's this skewed system.
Right.
And it reminded me so much of the auditioning system
because
it's true. There are just some people that are so skilled at auditioning.
Yeah.
I am not one of them. I do amazing work when I'm rehearsing, when I'm in the show, but my auditions are terrible. And it is only by the grace of the people that have seen me, like Kristen Blodgett and Patrick McCullum, who were able to see past the nerves and past the, you know, just anxious and desperation probably, to see there's potential there.
Right.
And that's what Hal was saying as well. He's like, I like to look past all of that, and I want to see the people that will succeed with me.
Right.
And that's what I loved about him too. And you said it just a second ago, collaboration. His whole life was about collaboration.
Yeah.
That is so hugely important, because I think that there are so many people that are in this business, especially in the directing and the producing side, that are just like, me, 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 I'm the most important. I'm the top of the ladder. And everyone else, you know, it goes down from there, which is not the case at all. It's a big, huge circle.
It is.
And it needs to be.
I am a novice at this directing, producing thing, but like, you know, I had, you know, this last show, I had an actress who was like, I mean, not like, she was writing her life story and she's bloodletting on the page.
Mm.
And then she has to go and perform her life story on a stage in front of people. And so, like, when you understand that you are facilitating a space in which a human being is bearing scars, wounds, bloodletting, and just putting it all out there on display to, like I said before, be judged and critiqued, and for your entertainment or your connection to, so that you can feel like, as an audience member, that you too have been seen and heard, and that somebody is telling a part of your story, so that when you, as a producer or a director, understand what your actors are giving to you, and an audience, you should have the most reverence for the work that they're doing and the most respect for the work that they're doing, because it is so extremely hard. And without your actors, you have nothing.
Right.
If you're a producer or director, who are you directing if you don't have an actor? Nothing. You know what you're directing. You're going to do like Hal did when he was a little boy, and you're going to have a cardboard box and you're going to have some toy soldiers and nurses. And that's going to be your show. If you don't know how to have respect for your actors, and if you don't understand that it is absolutely a collaboration, and you have nothing without them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, you just don't have anything if you don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand this hierarchy, I'm better than you situation, because you're not. You don't have a show without them.
Right. Right.
Makes no sense to me.
It really doesn't. I mean, that is the kind of crux to this world.
Yeah.
Where we're made to feel almost less than. And I'm just going to go on a tangent, because you know that's what I love to do. I just lost my train of thought. What were we just talking about?
About collaboration.
Thank you. Wow. That's old person brain right there. So you've got your stage actors and you've got your cinema actors.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a delineation in terms of how they are treated, how they are paid.
Yeah.
I mean, huge, the payments.
Huge discrepancy.
Huge.
I mean, a lot of actors who love theater more, they do movies and TV just so they can survive.
Yeah.
And then leave and immediately go to theater as fast as they can. I just read an article with Maggie Smith.
Mm.
Don't we all love Maggie
Smith? Love her.
And she was talking about the two hugest, most well-known roles that she has ever had, which are the part in Harry Potter.
McGonagall.
And the part she has on Downton Abbey. And she was like, it's not fulfilling work.
Mm.
I didn't feel challenged. She was like, I really want to be doing theater. The woman's in her 80s. She'd rather be on stage doing 8 shows a week.
Yeah.
but like
than making $1 million an episode,
right.
Sitting in a chair all day, right. Basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, she's excellent.
No, she's amazing. No, like, we're not taking away.
She like
talent is talent.
That's just the thing is like in order to survive, like and have an income where you can like buy a home and all these different things, like you have to get some television work. You have to get some film work because it's just like,
yeah,
the discrepancy is so huge.
It's ridiculous.
That's like the other thing that's really fascinating about Hal, right? Is that,
oh yeah, that's your retirement.
is that like his story about he? I already told you about what happened when he was a little boy, but his family was at first like quite wealthy, and then the Great Depression happened, and so in he said around 1938 they lost most everything, and they ended up in this little apartment on the Upper West Side, and he would be sitting at his window, looking out the window, feeling terrible about the world, and about how things were. And he would go to opening nights and all these different things in his mind. And at 14, he was having a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Because he was finding himself walking through the streets of Central Park talking to himself. And it's like to have a nervous breakdown and feel like the world is closing in on you at such a young age, and somehow miraculously be able to pull yourself up out of that and be like, no, 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 I have to survive and I have to push forward in order to pursue my dreams, and then have dreams that, like Pamela said, most people are like, but what's your backup plan?
Mm-hmm.
Hal never had a backup plan. He, like I said, he was listening to the opera when he was a little boy with a cardboard box, some nurses and soldiers, because that's what you could get at the Five and Dime, and he was directing shows.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he didn't, this is what he always wanted to do. And I think encouraging kids' dreams,
yeah,
encouraging people who are going to pursue their dreams instead of immediately putting a black cloud over them.
Right.
It's hard enough to be a creator.
Oh,
it's
completely.
So difficult to be one, and all of the mental gymnastics that you already have to go through in order to create a thing, and then to have somebody not be supportive.
Not just somebody, almost everybody, yeah, from family members, yeah, and friends to complete strangers that decide they're going to give their 2 cents whether you want it or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hard part.
It really is.
I mean, the number of times I heard it when I was in high school, too, because I told them I'm going to move to New York and I want to be on Broadway. I'm going to be on Broadway. Yeah. But that can't be accepted. They have to, well, they have to warn me, and it's all coming from a good place where they want me to succeed. So you've got to have a backup plan. Well, I don't, because I'm not going to go to college. That's another zinger for you. What else what else can you say to me about that? Do you know what I mean? And yeah, it was like, you know, I think actually, though, that kind of helped me a lot because, yeah, I tend to fight against authority. So if authority is saying, well, no, no, college is the next step. Not for me. Sorry.
You're the exact opposite of what you said.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't enjoy my time this last 12 years, so I shall bid adieu to the academic system and find my own way. Thank you so very much.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, it's, I mean, it's ridiculous stuff like that. So to tell a 14-year-old that he can't have his dream because his dream isn't going to pay the bill. Right. While he was already in a depressed state. Yeah. Because honestly, at
God
that time,
what
too.
Would have happened to him.
Right. But during the Great Depression, though, kids had to grow up real fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There just wasn't any way around it.
No.
So at 14, he was probably closer to his mid-20s.
Totally. I mean, remember the sketch of him as a 14-year-old in Central Park? He's wearing a suit and tie. I'm like, I don't know any 14-year-olds who, I mean, most
of that might have been that time of
course,
of the,
but like,
yeah.
Now it's like, can you just pull up your pants?
Right.
That's all. I just would like you to wear a belt. If I could get you in a
or
belt.
Or just a pair of pants that fits.
Something.
I'm cool with that.
Just so that, like, you know, they're above your butt, I'd be real happy. I feel like that's where we're at this point in time. But yeah, so like he pulled himself up out of that space, and then He went to college, and then he walked into the agent's office and did a resume of all the shows he wished he had directed, but had directed none of them, and, like, gave it to this agent who was on the phone with a man who ran a summer stock company, and he he got the job and bankrupted the summer stock company in two shows. So funny.
Maybe not for the summer stock company.
No, definitely not for the summer stock company, but, like, in hindsight, I mean, now you can be like, Hal Prince bankrupted ours, you know what I mean?
Right.
He, like, tried to bring it back or whatever, but it's just like, I was like, oh my. But it's like, nowadays, you could never do that.
No.
Like, because the interwebs would blow up
right.
while you're lying.
Yes.
You know, like, you can't just do
As
that.
As well it should.
Yeah, truly. Although...
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
The thing is that if those things hadn't worked out for him the way that they had, he wouldn't be who he was.
Well, I think, and I will just go a step further and say that I think that we put too much stock nowadays in what you have done already.
Totally.
When if I'm a newbie, how am I supposed to get the experience that you want me to have if you don't give me the chance to get experience?
Totally. And it's a thing that I think a lot of us have butted up against.
Yeah.
It's a thing I'm constantly butting up against, and it's just why I just do my own stuff, because...
Yeah.
It's like, if you could just have a little bit of imagination.
Right.
It's like, everyone I work with is like, oh, she's great at this. Why aren't you doing this full time? if you want to talk
from your mouth to God's ear.
Thank you.
I do remember, you know, because this happens every once in a while. This is maybe not the best thing to ever say to anybody. But I had just finished I was playing Pennywise in Urinetown, mm-hmm. and one of the other guys in the cast who I had also done another show with said, why don't they want to cast you? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And you're just like, thanks? I don't know how to take that.
Right. Also, I don't know how to answer. Like, I don't know. Would you like, can you talk to them?
Oh, why aren't you working?
Yeah.
Gosh, I just wish I knew, because if I know, then I could actually, you know, get cast. That would be that would be thrilling for me.
Yeah.
Thanks. It's just such a strange, I mean, and I get it.
Right.
It's coming from a place of like, you're so talented. Right. And it is frustrating. It's frustrating for people that are watching it happen to talented people.
Right.
And it's equally, if not horrendously more frustrating for the people that are going through it.
Right. Totally. Totally.
We need more Hal Princes in this world.
Yeah.
We need people like Hal Prince, like Kristen Blodgett, who I mentioned earlier, like Craig Burns, mm-hmm. who are willing to take a step outside of what society wants and of what the money people behind them want,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and say, you know what? I hear what you're saying, but I see something special about this person.
It's fun to watch, like, West Side Stories, it started previews this week or opened.
Mm-hmm.
I think it opened. And like 90% of the cast, it's their Broadway debut.
Yeah.
Which is flipping awesome.
I know, I love that.
It's flipping awesome. And it's just like, this is the kind of Broadway we should be having more of, and less of, let's just put a name in.
Now, I will say, I'm going to put a little bit of a pall on this, because with a show that has already proven itself that people are going to come to anyway, it doesn't matter as much if you've got names.
Right. But, like, look at all the shows that have their own name that they still put a name in. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many shows like that.
Yeah.
I'm just like, but we don't need a name for this. Everybody knows this show.
Yeah.
Just put somebody who would be amazing.
Right.
No one knows. Why? Why can't you do that?
Not enough Twitter followers?
Maybe. I don't know.
It does make me want to, like, I wish that he was sitting on this couch with us and we could ask him, like, what he thinks of the way things are going now.
No. That it he was able to touch a little bit on it because he definitely talked about, like, just the cost of trying to fund a show anymore when he was, you know, he said when he first started out, it was, like, a couple $1,000s, tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's millions, you know. It was like Hamilton was like $12 million.
I really don't understand where that money goes.
So expensive to get a show up anymore, and
which is why I feel like we've got so many episodes to talk about.
Yeah,
honestly,
it's really true.
Because if you have already put all of your money into something, then you don't have time or freedom to let it fail for a little bit.
Right.
It has to succeed immediately.
And that's sort of, I mean, and that's sort of what, like, Beetlejuice has the, because it has Warner Brothers behind it, it had the ability to kind of wait until the audience found it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, I mean, but you would think that with SpongeBob, right? Like it had Nickelodeon, but it was doing, like, 500,000, 300,000, which is not very good. And especially for a show that's not cheap like that.
And it was a huge cast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. So, you know, it's just really interesting to listen to this man who's been around for so many years just talk about, he's like, I don't know if I could be producing anymore because it's so expensive and he has 21 Tonys, you know. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Then the other thing that was, like, really I loved about his story, he works for George Abbott, he goes to the Korean War, he gets drafted into the Korean War, and then George Abbott says, when you come back, you'll have a job, kid. He writes to George Abbott for the 2 years he's gone. George Abbott never writes him back. He, the war ends, he comes home. Before he goes home to his parents, who are probably like, my son, you know what I mean? Before he goes home to his parents, he's like, I'm sorry, I've got to make a stop first. And George Abbott was working on, what was he working on?
I can't remember the name of the show.
George Abbott was working on a show we'd all know. I can't remember the name of it right now. He goes directly to the theater as soon as he is finished. And George's assistant is like has the normal response to seeing someone who's just come back from war. And George Abbott says, back so soon. And I was like, it's been 2 years. And he's like, well, time goes by fast.
But then he's like, oh, but I do have a job for you.
And he becomes the ASM at Wonderful Town.
Yeah.
And becomes friends with the gentleman who's the stage manager there. I have his name. Bobby Griffith. And there is when he decides to become a producer. They're like, well, we should become producers. So they do. and they decide that the first show ends up being The Pajama Game, and they decide that if they get George to direct, they'll have a name attached to it so that they'll be able to get funding. They have a great interview with George Abbott on there, who's in his 90s, I think, by that point, and says, they were telling me the story, and I was like, I don't think this is going to work. But the thing that I loved so much about all of the interviews there, also, when I watched, I rewatched the documentary, The Best Worst Thing That Could Have Ever Happened, and on YouTube, there's a few other interviews with Hal from when Prince of Broadway came to Broadway, and also there's one from 1978, which is magical, because it's Baby Hal, Baby Joel Grey, Baby Steven. It's so great. Just go on YouTube and watch it. It's just delightful. And it's when Hal's about to go direct Evita for the first time. It's super fun.
Oh, I loved the conversation that Andrew Lloyd Webber was having, too, about Evita specifically, because Hal brought so much. Mm-hmm. And this is what I loved about the collaboration, because even these, like, big people, Stephen Sondheim, obviously, but also, like, Andrew Lloyd Webber was like, oh, yeah, Evita wouldn't have been the show it was without Hal. Yeah. He gave me this whole idea for Perrone and for this, you know, for, I can't remember the name of the song, but the song where they do the musical chairs with one Perrone and the other military men. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought that was amazing.
It was great.
But he did that with several shows. But I loved what he said.
Cabaret was a cool story too.
Oh, and I was thinking more about the story that he was telling about Candor and Ebb and the Kiss of the Spider Woman.
Yeah.
Where he kept saying, I don't like this song. The song doesn't work. So rewrite it. And they would rewrite it and send it to him. And he would say, nope, that's the same song. Rewrite it. And they would rewrite it. No, that's the same song, too. It's just backwards. Write it again. And so they finally go, you know, Hal, you're on vacation right now. And you don't have anything to lose in this. Like, we're, you know, we are rewriting this song over and over again. But they finally wrote the song again. And he was like, it's the best song in the show.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the name of the song, though, right now.
I just remember... Cheetah is in a white tuxedo with
Gosh, what is the name of that song?
Piping, and she's dancing. And I can't
it's remember the name. Latin-y sounding.
Yes.
Oh shoot, but I'm gonna look it up.
Because what he says is basically when you tell a writer to rewrite something and they come back to you and they say, and they push back on it, it's because they don't think that they can write anything better.
Yeah.
And it's that constant belief that Hal has in the people he's working with.
Yes.
It's like an unshakable belief that deep within them is something magical. He knows it's there, and he's going to push you until you birth it, right? Like
But I can't tell what the title is.
But that's totally what it is. That's the right.
What you want? I don't know. Anyway, but it's Anyway,
yes,
that's what I loved about him.
Yeah.
Because he knew if he had to push you. And then he said something like, I would ask them the question, do you think this is the best it can be? And their answer would either be, I mean, I guess, you know, this could change or that could change. And then he goes, but then you'd have, oh, no, he was speaking specifically about Stephen Sondheim. And Stephen would be like, my guy could change this up. It could be a little bit better here or there. But then every once in a while, he'd be like, that's the song. Like that's gonna make the show.
Oh no!
Or no, you're gonna make that song or something like that.
Stephen said no. This is what it was. Stephen Sondheim would say to him, he would say, just work on it first.
Yeah. That's right.
So that he knew when he got to the rehearsal room and Hal started working on it, he'd be like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
Like, cute. They, like, even Stephen even says in the documentary, he's my best friend. So cute.
I know.
Like, that almost got me because I was like, his memorial service, I was like, I don't think I can deal with an upset Stephen Sondheim.
Ugh.
I can't, like, a 90-year-old Stephen Sondheim is not a thing I can handle. It's not.
I mean, this is, if we're going to really get into the modeling here. We've lost someone in this world that made such an impact, and it's hard to even imagine what it's going to be like now.
Yeah.
And I know that he wasn't as active in the business for the last decade or so.
I don't know, because, like, you look at Prince of Broadway, which, like, he directed, right?
Yeah.
And then I have one of the women who did... plays for the Women's Cycle, she has friends that were writing a musical and Hal was working with them.
Oh my gosh, wow.
And so, like, when he was supposed to come back from Switzerland from his vacation, like, they were supposed to be having a meeting with him, like,
wow.
On the calendar, and he had been working with them already for a while. So he was still very active doing what he loved at 91. I mean, if you watch these interviews, he's, you know, late 80s, early 90s, his mind is still sharp.
Oh, yeah.
He's using words I don't know. I'm like, that's an SAT word. I don't know. I think I get the gist, but I'm not quite sure.
I'm picking it up in context.
Yeah.
Oh, but it is a tragic thing for us to have lost a man like them. But on the positive side, yeah. So many people have been inspired by him that he's not disappearing.
No.
He's stardust in this community.
It's true.
He'll be there for ages. He'll be there for millennia. He's ageless. I've told you my story. Yeah. Do you want to hear it again?
What story?
My Hal Prince story.
No, I just know the Andrew Lloyd Webber story. I know the Andrew Lloyd Webber story.
Yes.
I know the Laura Benanti story. Mm-hmm. I do not know the Hal Prince story.
Okay, so buckle up.
Tell it.
This might have to be the end of the episode.
I'm not done now. There's some other things.
Well, then I'll wait.
Okay.
I'm just saying it's getting close to my bedtime.
Oh, I know.
I'm fading fast. I'm sorry.
I do want to talk about... I did want to talk a little bit about Hal's wife.
Oh, love her.
Yeah, I really, because that and what happened after Sweeney Todd and a quote from Mandy Patinkin, because the quote from Mandy Patinkin
is literally, I know exactly what you're going to say.
What our whole show is about. It really is.
Yeah.
So the reason why I want to talk about Judy Prince is because one of the things that Hal said about her was that, like, the whole reason he did most of the shows he did was because of her.
Mm.
Like, she would ask him the right questions, and she reformed his version of what success was, because she got very angry when he would say, she said to him, I wish you'd stop calling things either a flop failure or a...
a hit or a flop.
A hit or a flop. And she would get mad about that. And she said, I wish you'd start calling them a success or a failure. And the reason why she wanted him to change his verbiage around these issues was because she felt like there were a lot of things, and he said this, you know, that were an artistic success, but not necessarily a financial success.
Yes.
Right? Like, he felt like, you know, and so... She wanted him to really have the correct perspective, because if at the end of the day he felt like he did the absolute best he could do on something and he was actually really proud of it, even if the audiences didn't quite understand it, then that didn't mean he failed. That didn't mean that it
right.
was a flop. It didn't mean that it was a waste. It didn't mean that. It just meant that the audience didn't understand, but that was still something that you could be proud of. And a lot of those shows... that have found audiences since then. People, they have cult followings and
yes.
people love them.
Merrily We Roll Along.
Totally. It's a huge one. I mean, there's a movie that's going to take 20 years because they're doing Merrily We Roll Along in increments until the actors are the age that they're supposed to be.
I think that's amazing. So that's going to be really cool.
It's going to be so great. And so that's why I wanted to talk about Judy Prince, because, you know, when we're talking about, like, shows like Fosse Verdon, that just happened, and these very powerful women, which, you know, Judy doesn't have 21 Tonys,
right?
But, like, the reason Hal has 21 Tonys is because of Judy.
Yeah.
And
when there's a strong man, there's an equally strong woman behind them.
If not stronger.
Right.
And so then the reason why I also want to talk about Sweeney Todd was because Sweeney Todd... Everybody knows this show. It won a record number of Tony Awards.
Yeah, it swept.
It swept. And then Hal said he entered into the longest drought of his entire career.
Yep.
Immediately following the biggest hit of his entire career. It was 9 years.
Wow. I don't remember hearing that.
9 years.
Jeez. Yeah.
He would direct a show. It would get terrible reviews, and the thing that he would always do is 10 a.m. the next morning, he would always have a meeting on his calendar that 10 a.m.
For the next show.
Yeah, for the next show. It was 10 a.m. after the opening night. He would always do that. And there are a lot of producers nowadays, young people, who, like, try to follow the Hal Prince model, because the thing was, like, he never, ever gave up, even during the longest drought of his career. And things like Merrily We Roll Along that, I mean, sadly, you know, if you watch The Best Worst Thing That Ever Happened, you'll see that, you know, they say basically that Steven and Hal didn't do another collaboration after that. And it wasn't like they weren't best friends, because they're still best friends. You can find plenty of pictures of them laughing in each other's faces. Like I said, that documentary was done last year, and Steven's like, he's my best friend. Like, they just adored, they were brothers. But it was such a huge wound for them, because it birthed, like, if you watch that documentary, the amount of actors and creators that we love now, you know, for our generation, came, like, they grew up, like, loving Hal and Steven, loving them, you know? And so they felt like they let all these kids down.
Yeah.
And that just broke them. Just broke them. Just love those men. I just love them. So,
me too.
I know.
What, so, I know what the quote is, but tell me the Mandy Patinkin quote that you've got.
Yeah, so the Mandy Patinkin quote is, okay. One of the greatest gifts that the guys like Hal and Sondheim can give us is when they fail. Because if those guys can fail, doing the best they can, so can we. They forget what a gift their struggle is, because they are so fallible and great at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that's what our entire podcast is about.
Right.
That right there.
Yeah. That, because we call them flops in the way that we talk about this show, Broadway flops, six, you know, hits and misses, whatever it is. But behind those flops are some very talented people, not just Steven and Hal, but incredibly talented people who just didn't have a great show that time.
Yeah.
And the important thing is that even if you do have a failure or a show that isn't successful in the critical sense, that you just keep on trying.
Right.
Because chances are, maybe not the next one, but one of the times that you try again is going to be the time that you succeed.
Yeah.
And we will all be blessed for it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, even some of those flops, like, we just love.
Yeah. All right. So now I've got 7 minutes to tell you my story.
Tell me the story.
All right. So we were in Washington, D.C. with the Phantom Tour.
Mm-hmm.
We had just finished the show. Bow to the audience. Everyone's clapping. They're all on their feet. It's great. Curtains close. And just to the right, standing unobtrusively with his glasses perched on his forehead, Hal Prince. And we all see this. And we're all kind of looking at each other going, do you guys see? Is that Hal Prince? Like, and so it's like this hubbub that starts, and then all of a sudden he just walks in. He's like, hey, kids, I didn't know you were here. I'm here in Washington, D.C. I'm here to see my friend Mario, but I saw that you were here, so I wanted to just stop by. You guys are great. Keep up the good work. And then he left, and it was like the most amazing experience. Because I don't,
so
he didn't see the show. I know.
I was visiting my friend and I had to come by and say hi. It's like, he's just like your next door neighbor.
That's exactly what it felt like. Like, hey kids. And he called us kids. And I love that. Hey kids. I was just in town. I just happened to be in town and I saw that you guys were playing. I just wanted to say. And it was just, I mean, it was truly remarkable. It's one of those experiences that I will never, ever forget. And the feeling that I had at the time that it happened. Because I remember, like, blue curtain, velvet curtain closed. And then the lights, you know, we have to wait for the lights to come up again.
Mm-hmm.
Lights come up. Is that Hal Prince? I think that's Hal Prince. It was amazing. I mean, you couldn't see that acting just then, because
I
just remembered that this was a podcast.
It was really great.
Thank you. I was looking around, searching for, I was looking at the other people on stage with me, asking if they knew that that was Hal Prince. That was what was going on. But anyway, I mean, it was really remarkable. But that right there is the kind of person that Hal Prince was, is, and forever shall be remembered being, is just that true human being, kind, collaborative, compassionate.
And his A lot of people said his infectious.
Oh, yeah. Everyone said infectious. I love it. Passion and passion. Excitement. Yes.
Yeah. I love that this is, I promise we'll end on this note. I think he had so much energy at the very beginning that he was like, I knew I was a pain. He was just so excited. And so on every legal pad at the start of, like, every show, he would just write in all caps, watch it. Because he knew he was annoying, and he didn't want to be annoying. He was just so excited.
Yeah.
You know? And so then, like, that infectious excitement and joy just, like, permeated. And Mandy Patinkin said, he's just so positive, sometimes you want to punch him.
Yes.
Like, oh.
But I feel like Mandy Patinkin is kind of the exact opposite of Hal Prince, which is, I think, why he would just, yeah. But anyway,
although
he's an amazing. No, I'm not saying
right. But when you see like the interviews, like even Merrily, I love Mandy said he was so jealous he wanted to be in the show with the kids so bad. And he was like, I was too old.
Yep. Poor Mandy.
Whatever became of him.
I'm just kidding.
Everyone just wanted to be around those guys.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's true.
One of my friends told me a great Steven story yesterday, and then I was like, I totally get why they were friends, because they're both just the nicest.
Yeah.
And they're just like, really get excited about the smallest thing.
And what Hal said, he thought the most important thing in finding an actor is truth.
Yeah.
And they were truthful people. They were true human beings. They were true people.
Yeah.
And I think that is what it is.
Yeah, really.
Truth is a magnet for truth.
Mm-hmm.
All right. True. We have to sign off now.
I do. Thank you guys for
Thanks
listening.
For listening. All right. Bye.
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.